I want to take a little time to make three major points and then to finish with a few, in fact, more than a few, obligatory acknowledgements. The first point I want to make is that this volume is a legacy of David Sissons. It's only because of his extraordinary efforts that the story of D Special Section could be reconstructed and published. He, as others have noted, was assiduous and indefatigable. He's owed a great debt by scholars and practitioners concerned with the science of cryptography, as well as historians of the cryptological aspects of the war in the Pacific. Sissons, through this volume, has opened the door to further research in at least four subjects. I want to go through these one by one. The first concerns the role of cryptanalysis of Japanese diplomatic signals in contributing to the outcome of the war. There are numerous volumes by both veterans and historians of the Allied cryptanalytic activities concerned with Japanese Navy and Japanese Army and Air Force codes and ciphers. But now, a study of the contribution of cryptanalytic activity with respect to Japanese diplomatic codes and ciphers is possible. There are a number of particularly interesting intercepts and decrypts that I just want to run through, which tell us about different aspects of the diplomatic code-breaking effort with respect to the war. The first is an intriguing message that Professor Trendall sent to the Australian Special Wireless Group at Bob Giller, who were actually doing the radio intercepts, in October of 1942, in which he congratulated a couple of its members for, quote, one of the most valuable messages received since the section started. He didn't actually tell them what was in that message that they had intercepted. And we still don't know from archives what that message was, other than the fact that it was valuable. There's a whole series of Japanese diplomatic traffic between Khrushchev, which after the Nazis had surrounded Moscow became in effect the Soviet capital, and Tokyo in February of May 1943, which revealed that Tokyo had adopted a policy of complete accommodation with the Soviet Union, which they continued for the next couple of years. Some of that has been transcribed in full, and fortunately the Americans kept copies of some of that, which are available in American National Archives. There's Ronald Bond's message, and you should have seen a photo of Ronald Bond up there before, to the 52nd Special Wireless Section at Bonner Giller on the 3rd of April 1943, when he says, quote, although contents of messages cannot be revealed to you, nevertheless, it was the most important thing taken in the last 3 months and was of much value to the authorities. Bond sent Bonner Giller another message on the 25th of May, 43, in which he said both quantity and quality of traffic to and from RTZ, which is the circuit from Khrushchev to Tokyo, during the last fortnight had been most pleasing. There's a message from Archer, one of the British members of D Special Section, to Bonner Giller on 20 April 1943, saying the traffic from Tokyo to Khrushchev during recent weeks was, quote, especially valuable. There's a report which had been intercepted and translated from a Japanese spy informing Tokyo that at the Yalta Conference, Stalin had agreed to enter the war against Japan within 3 months of the defeat of Germany. There's a translation by Cyril James of the account by the Japanese minister in Kabul of how the Afghans had made him pull up his floorboards and reveal a small arsenal that he had been amassing under his floor. There's information about the transport of Australian prisoners of war to Japan by sea, which would have been very useful to the Australian authorities. There's also information there about the movements of the German submarine U-862 and its deprivations in Bass Strait in December of 1944. And there's a message dispatched by the Japanese representative in Dili revealing that the Japanese were reading the Australian guerrilla code in East Timor, which had led to the deaths of many Australians in Timor. They're just examples which we're able to find of these diplomats diplomatic intercepts. They're only a very, very minute proportion of the number which were being intercepted literally each day. The possibility now of proceeding to put together a much more comprehensive account of the information which was revealed in this diplomatic deciphering effort is really promising in terms of what we can say about the special section and the diplomatic side of the enterprise with respect to the war. Secondly, we now know a lot more about the actual breaking of the Japanese diplomatic codes and ciphers in terms of how the classic scholars and the mathematicians, as photos you're seeing in D special section, actually broke them. I talked to Trendle before he died. He had been able to break the daily cipher of the Greater East Asian Ministry, Tokyo, to its consulates around the world so quickly and routinely that he could usually send the solution to London before work began there the next morning. But he was not able himself to explain how he did this, other than that he said, I can see patterns there under these numbers that you're seeing. I can see patterns underneath there which enable me to then break those codes. He wasn't a mathematician. His profession, in fact, was putting together ancient Greek vases and reconstructing Greek and Egyptian hieroglyphics. The third area is that these intercepts or decrypts reveal the existence of a large network of Japanese spies in India. Sessions recalled in a letter that he wrote to Ian Smith in August of 1990 that intercepted cables on the YAK circuit from Kabul in Afghanistan to Tokyo contained information about such spies. There's a message from Kabul in 1942 which revealed that a Japanese agent was present at a British naval trial and was supplying full details of British carriers and battleships stationed in Bombay. There's another cable which gave the name and address of a spy in India. And a third one mentioned a spy called Bengal Tiger. Who were these spies? What were their roles? And how important were they? Were they caught? And if so, was this because of the deciphering done by D Special Section? I'd love a PhD student to take that up as a project. There's the issue of Soviet spies in Australia and the transfer of Allied intelligence material from Khrushchev to Tokyo. We've long known that General Blamey was informed in late 1944 and in turn informed the acting minister for the army on 6 January of 1945 that details of Allied war plans were known in full in Tokyo and then sent to Japanese field commanders within several days of their compilation for war cabinet meetings. We know, for example, that when Australians landed at Tarakan and other places in Borneo and elsewhere, that the Japanese had had full information about those Australian landings and had prepared themselves, were waiting for them. We now also know that these special sections radio intercept station at Mornington and evidently another station near Darwin was monitoring Soviet traffic from Khrushchev to Harbin and Tokyo, the RTZ circuit, before the end of the war with Japan in August of 1945. They were almost certainly engaged in this by around May, June 1945, and they were probably engaged in it a few months before that. And some of the correspondence relating to this is reproduced in the appendix to this book. But many questions remain, including the content and the distribution of those Mornington intercepts and their current location, assuming that they've been saved somewhere, because the authorities have still refused to make those intercepts public. The second general point I want to make is that it's crucial in democracy for intelligence activities to be subject to proper scrutiny. We know that bureaucrats by themselves are unwilling to release to the public the sort of information contained in this book, even 70 years afterwards, without sustained pressure. it's very likely that the 1946 cryptographic report would have remained unreleased and unknown about were it not for Sisson's persistence fueled by his knowledge of its existence. That is the report which makes up chapter 3 of this book, which the government has now reclassified as top secret. The only way that you can read about these particular codes and ciphers is by reading this book. They've been taken out of the archives after Sisson's had managed to get them temporarily, as it turned out, released. And the third point I want to make is that there are important implications for academic research in this story. I don't think that the sort of lengthy, detailed, time-consuming correspondence reproduced in the annexes of this book is possible in academia anymore. The academic political economy, to quote Nick Farrelly, is very different today than what it was just two decades ago. To beaver away in one's own idiosyncratic fashion, if I can describe it as idiosyncratic, essentially oblivious to daily departmental dictates, would not be allowed anymore. The opportunity costs of time spent on really deep research at the expense of articles and whatever peer-favoured journals might be the current fashion would not be acceptable anymore. A dearth of public productivity would simply not be tolerated. Sisson's exhaustive correspondence is in practice incompatible with the norms of emailing. It means, unfortunately, that inevitably this sort of fundamentally important research has effectively become impossible, with terrible consequences for my previous point about democracy. I have a list of acknowledgements that I want to quickly run through. To Arthur Stockman, now Emeritus Professor of Japanese Studies at Oxford University, one of the world's leading experts in Japanese studies, and Sisson's first PhD student, who first initiated this project. Bronwyn Sisson's, who supported us from the very outset of this project. Professors David Horner and John Mack, who assisted us at key points throughout this project, and John for his participation with us here today. The Australian War Memorial and the National Archives of Australia, the repositories of many of the key documents which we cite in our volume. Dr. Craig Reynolds, who was standing up the back a while ago, who mentored us through the early parts of this publication process. Our publishers, ANUE Press, and particularly Duncan Beard and Beth Batrick. Cameron Hawker, whose grandmother, Margaret McBrien, has been shown in this photo there, in fact, who worked at the Mornington Intercept Station and who was the first intercept operator to be turned over to monitoring the Soviet traffic in the pursuit of these spies who were passing the material to Moscow and thence Moscow passing it through Kaibyshev to Tokyo. My family, Annabelle and our kids, my sister who are here today with me this evening, and a special mention to son James, who scanned many of the pieces which are reproduced in the annexes here. Those who organised today's event for us. Andrew Carr. Thanks, Andrew. You've done a great job this evening. Kerry Hogan. Olivia Cable, who's helped us in many ways, including putting together the PowerPoint presentation that we've had. Nick Farrelly. Nick, for many things. Colin Graham, who prepared many of the photos for use in these PowerPoints. Belinda Cranston from the CAPS Media Office, who prepared the press release and the video we saw at the beginning of the proceedings. The cartography, Carto GIS unit, who prepared some of the diagrams which we've used in the text. And finally, to Brendan Taylor and Ian Hall, for their kind words and their participation in the events this afternoon. Did you want to say a few words?
Yes. Yes, just a few words, or briefly. I'm not the expert of military or diplomatic intelligence. My background is more anthropology and history of cross-cultural experience. So what I read in this story of this special section is might be quite different from what Des or John read, but it might be interesting to share that with you today. Oh, well, but firstly, I like to mention how I remember David Sissons. I met David for the first time in late 1990s when I was working for the War Memorial in a project called Australia-Japan Research Project. But I got to know David much better in 2002 when I had a fellowship at the National Library. And then we started to talk about various things. And when I was talking to him, David, I never called him David, it's his first name. He was always, for me, Sissons Sensei. Sensei means teacher or master. And he was very polite at the beginning, but as I got to know him, we started talking about various things, and he had wealth of knowledge, and he was so generous to share that with me and with other students and researchers, as both Des and John said. For example, if I make casual inquiry to David, he would do his own little research, write it up, and convert that into PDF file and send it to me. So I was always appreciative of his help. And then when I was compiling this book, I noticed a rather curious thing. There were many, particularly the annex section of this book, which comes at the end, there were many letters from David to Des reporting about the research, outcome, and further questions. But there was no reply letters from Des to David. So I asked Des, why that? And then Des told me that when he received letters from David, very polite, but very intense and dense letters, Des just walked to David's office, knocked on his door, and had a chat. So that was the kind of a interaction Des and David had. Then when I pictured David and Des together, I couldn't help but just to smile. There's just a contrast. David as a rather shy and thin figure, and Des as people can see it, quite a presence. I never saw them together, but I could just imagine. But what those two academics were passionate about was this pursuit of the information and the issue on the special section. And then David actually started this research in the 1970s after the publication of an article by Des and David Horner. So it went on from 70s to 80s, 90s, and then until he passed away. And after he passed away, Des picked it up and worked with me and also Arthur Stockwin, and the book has just come out. So it's been a long kind of work, but this the book, which is now out, is about the de-special section, where it was a top secret organization, and the best and brightest men and also women were involved. Each member was brilliantly sharp, and between them, they had expertise in mathematics, Greek, Latin, French, and German. They worked intensely during the war. But what struck me most was that they collaborated. They worked together. And not only among themselves, they worked with language experts, which included David, and also people who worked in those listening stations. So the book managed to bring out this hidden story, but also bring out the story about collaboration and cooperation. And working on this book, I had the privilege to witness the lasting friendship and the trust between the two academics, namely Des and David, even though I never saw them together. I feel proud to know such a close and productive relationship was nurtured here at the ANU. And I hope the same type of relationship, which is supported by trust and passion, is taking place among us current academic members. And I hope it will continue across the generation among the academics and the students who are following us. So lastly, I wanted to thank everybody who came to this launch today. And then all the names were already mentioned by Bronwyn and Des, so I won't repeat them. But I hope you will enjoy the book, even though it might not be so easy, as John mentioned. But it is a fascinating book, not only as a history, but also the details and this combination of human drama and the detail of code breaking. And in that sense, it's a unique and a bit quirky book, I think. Thank you very much.